Hello and welcome to We Cut Heads, a Spike Lee podcast. I'm your host Spencer, and with me is he's a no good thief that's stealing cold sodas from the local store at the train station.
Wait, what? Wait, which one? Which one am I?
You're the girl with the. Okay,
I'm one of the ladies.
Yeah, with the cool earrings.
Yeah. I don't know. I got to get into, like, why it wasn't allowed, but I can guess a couple of reasons. But either way, I'm really good at my business. And that business is getting people to drink soda.
Some nice American Coca-Cola. I assume it was a Coca-Cola. They never specify.
Yeah, it doesn't say in the bottom.
Yeah. But, so this is a special episode, secret episode. Who cares? It's we have by this time about a month and a half left. This season was on black film and stuff like that. This is yet another excuse for me to shoehorn in another movie, another episode on an African movie. This time Cairo Station, with a special guest, sort of a crossover episode with the Magic Lantern podcast. So thank you guys for coming on.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So, for those who aren't familiar, what is the Magic Lantern? And also, who are you two?
Thank you. I'm Erica, and I'm with my husband, Cole. And we are the Magic Lantern podcast, and we cover films we love and the things we love about them.
Yeah, it's basically just a run through our own personal canon, and we alternate choices back and forth between the episodes, so it will be one of mine, one of Erica's, on through... And we cover a wide variety of stuff, everything from genre films to international to art house to classics. It's a pretty wide variety. The only brief it has to fit is if we love the film and want to share it.
Yeah, and to start off, I would highly recommend the Welcome to a Dollhouse episode. Because, one, I love that movie, and also it doesn't get enough love like it should or used to. I feel like it used to get a lot of love, and now it's kind of overlooked. But that and Darat was another great one. But, like, there's over 100 episodes at this point. So if you haven't been listening in, there's plenty to dig into.
Which one are you telling me to watch? That's the question. I'm not going to listen to the Welcome to the Dollhouse one because I'm not going to watch that movie. I don't care what you say.
Yes, I know you don't want to watch Welcome to Dollhouse. But okay, so this. thanks for throwing me off, but
that's what I do.
Yeah. So Cairo Station is a film from 1958. It's an Egyptian film by Yosef Chahine. I'm not 100% how to say it, but he was one of the. First, like, major African directors, although his family's Greek, but he grew up in Egypt, so I guess would still count as an African director, but that's kind of neither here nor there. But he made a lot of movies. His career was a very, very long career, and Cairo Station is kind of the big one that everyone knows, and it's the only one that I knew about for a long time. And
it's on Netflix.
Yes, it's on Netflix, which I don't understand how it got there, but I'm glad it's there. And they have almost all of his other movies. I started watching this his 3-hour historical epic earlier today, but then I realized I had other stuff to do. But I'll get to it eventually. But Cole and Erica, what's your guys' history with Cairo Station?
Well, I came upon it a few years ago, and just in 2019, just last year, I went through a project where I was trying to watch a lot more African film. And so I thought it was a great excuse to revisit that as the very first one. It was the title that kicked off my year of really diving into African film throughout 2019.
Because you watched at least one title a week, right?
Yeah, sometimes I watched more. Just over 50.
And you've been talking to me about the film for a long time, but this was a first watch for me, so thank you for giving me the opportunity to do it right now.
Who are you thanking? Because Spencer didn't do it. No, I'm just kidding.
It's the universal you.
Yeah, I guess you're gesturing at me. Yeah,
thank you to the universe.
Yes, thank you to everyone involved.
Yeah, and Joel, had you heard of this movie before I told you we're doing this?
I feel like I had. Like, you know, I used to listen to film spotting. I don't want to brag or anything like that. But, like, I feel like this is something maybe not from film spotting, maybe from some other random film podcast that I used to listen to where Cairo Station was, you know, casually mentioned or something like that. And more than once. So I feel like I'd heard of it, but I didn't look it up. I didn't know anything about it. So, I was pretty excited to see a pre-1980 movie on Netflix at all. And a foreign film that was in black and white from the 50s. Yeah, that's quite a find. It also turned out to be very good anyways.
Yeah. And there's a part that, well, we're going to spoil it, but who cares? Don't think you can really spoil this movie. But where I got worried, like, oh no, I should have researched if animals were hurt in this movie when I was watching it. But luckily...
Yeah, I was waiting for something to happen. It was okay.
Yeah, luckily it didn't go that way. Because I knew you would have come in pretty hot if it happened.
Oh yeah, I would have drove out to... Where do you live, New Zealand, and kicked your butt? No, Delaware, sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah, right around the corner.
Yeah, home of... I don't want to talk about him. Anyway, but... you know who I'm talking about. Anyway, but...
No, I don't, but yeah, that's fine.
Yeah. But, yeah, so where do you guys want to start with Cairo Station? Doing this, like... Because it's A very loose plot is not really A to B. It's more like a couple like characters and their lives around the like titular Cairo Station.
Well, I like the idea of the station as a metaphor for the city and for Egyptian society at large, first of all.
And it's really a crossroads for everyone.
Yeah, it's a dangerous place to navigate. We see that metaphor about halfway through the film of literally having to lay across the tracks to scrounge for dropped money. It makes me think how much I would really love to see a Frederick Wiseman documentary about Cairo Station. I think that would be incredible.
I think he would discover all the trunk murders, especially.
that part when that child almost gets run over by a train, that was too close for me. I was like, oh, okay, they literally pulled that kid right away, or just before the train.
Just in the nick of time, yeah. Moment, it feels like, that isn't fraught with some sort of peril for someone involved in this film.
Yeah.
And like a movie that's basically just people talking, it feels like an action movie in some parts, the way it's paced and, like, the editing. Where, like, there are a couple moments where it's, like, where, like, it legit felt like I'm watching, like, a, like, John Wick or something like that. This, like, the way it's, like, that's how dramatic things got. And it's not, like, melodramatic in, like, a Almodovar kind of way where it's, like, kind of, like, soap opery. It still manages to be, like, realistic and grounded, but just, it's heightened so much, but not too much.
Energetic, right?
It feels like those noir elements at play that make it move so quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Joel with energetic is right on the money. It has such a vibrancy when you're watching it. It's a very modern energy for a film that's 60 years old, it feels like. And I think a lot of that is because maybe we recognize similar politics that are still affecting our day-to-day lives now. You see, these soft drink vendors, they're operating on the fringes of the law, and we've all seen in the last few years that what can begin as a minor infraction quickly turns dangerous or even deadly, depending on who is pursuing you or who is responding to the call. You basically just swap out loose cigarettes for soft drinks, and you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And the use of music constantly to change tone or mood, and that, again, crossroads of traditional meets modern.
Yeah, and I always bring this up with, like, the African films, but there were a couple key moments where you would see, like, someone dressed more traditionally, like Egyptian, and they're speaking Arabic, and then you'd see someone dressed modern, like with the young, I guess, teen girl. I'm not even sure she's ever given a name, but like she speaks French, and she's like wearing like a Western style dress and like European style shoes, and like there's just, like a distinct cultural difference that is. That is subtle, but it's there if you're paying attention.
They all have to converge at this station, you know, from every time period, every language, probably every level of wealth, but we don't see anyone that looks particularly rich, even the bosses, I'd say.
I think those few instances where you see men in suits and trench coats, it signals, you know, business to me, so that seems like at least middle class or slightly above, but those disparities are so huge.
Yeah. When I think about the drink sellers again, they're basically part of the exploited class. They're stuck in between. And then you have porters attempting to form a union, injured workers, people who can't afford health care. It's very much working class, the concerns that are being dealt with.
Yeah.
And it's all still extremely relevant, too.
Yeah, especially I won't delve too much into it, but my old job, the stuff with the union in this movie was a little too familiar. And it's like, oh, this is making me frustrated and angry all over again.
Yeah.
Is that because somebody dropped a safe on your hand one time?
Metaphorically?
Yeah, metaphorically.
Yeah. I like how film noirs are almost never about, you know, even they're, you know, if it's a detective that's running the case and he's got nice suits, he's got a nice suit that he like takes care of and stuff like that. It's usually people on the lower end, and the story always goes there. I really that's the kind of film I need right now. To stay angry, that is.
All right.
You see, even the divisiveness between subsects of the working class too. You see politics among the porters. There's not enough work to go around for everybody. You see class distinctions being made even between soft drink sellers and newspaper vendors. So it's the same old game. You keep the working classes at each other's throats, basically.
Yeah. And going off what you guys were saying about the noir influences, like, to me, this feels like a confluence of like French New Wave and Italian neorealism and Japanese New Wave. It seems like this like nexus point of like all these different international influences. Even though Japanese New Wave, I don't know how well or how much those are distributed internationally at the time, but like part of it does feel like tapping into like Kobayashi. Would get into and like Imamura a little bit with Imamura, not too much, and the French New Wave with like dealing with like the like noir and like the genre elements were like and I also felt like Hitchcock at certain points too, so it's just amazing, like, but it still feels very individual at the same time.
Yeah, I was just making notes about that too right before we came on. I was kind of jotting down where I see this coming from, where I see it going. Hitchcock definitely, you know, with Rope and The Trunk, that immediately came to mind. Psycho was another thing, you know, the psychosexual thriller and how that changed how audiences went to the movies, basically. And I can see Cairo Station probably doing that for Egyptian audiences too. And I think all of the influences that you mentioned, I feel all that, especially the Italian neorealism, I really feel in the character of Hanuma, I see echoes of things like Bitter Rice, and then the Young Lovers subplot. gives it some of that melodrama, Grand Hotel, everybody comes to Cairo Station kind of vibe. And then, even more strangely, that swinging combo on the train is a scene straight out of an Elvis movie, almost.
And also, it feels like a silent movie. Just like the way everything, it managed to be subtle, but also very not subtle. And a lot of it is like just pure visual storytelling. And there are several scenes where there could be no dialogue and it can just be silent and you would still be able to follow everything that's happening.
Yeah, I totally see that. Erica watches films with no sound all the time, so she's already prone to do that. Did you feel... I mean, you could watch this whole thing with no sound, probably.
I think you could. And imagine that title card of, could we have foreseen his end based on this? Well, yeah, duh. And then also, maybe don't have a knife vendor right outside the station itself. So you put those two things together, you don't need sound.
Yeah, it's that old Chekhov thing of you buy a knife in the first act, it's got to show up in the third act.
Absolutely.
I feel like I should make a Tumblr of knife vendors in movies. Because I'm thinking of, obviously this guy we just saw, but in Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, there's that weird guy. I think he has knives, but he also has other metal tools. What's this guy about? Not in real life, though. I was going to say, when you said you watch movies silent all the time, did you mean silent movies or do you mean that you watch movies with sound but with the sound off?
I turn the sound off.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
A second or third pass, you know.
Right, not the first
time.
Okay. Yeah.
But
okay.
It's interesting when you do that because you see so many things. You're paying more attention to facial expression and all sorts of things that you might have missed, or at least I miss the first time around when I sit on the couch with her and we do that. Certain things pop out that you would have never thought of.
I think it gives you sometimes a different perspective on an actor's performance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I can totally see that. I did have a visualization of you sitting in a movie theater when the new Jurassic Park movie comes out and you put earmuffs over and you just kind of lean your head.
That sounds like a great plan.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, the other thing I was thinking about, we were talking about all of these influences as far as where he's coming from. I would be really curious to know what films that he admired. But also, you see kind of presaging things where we're headed. His shed, his obsession and frustration with women, with all these pinups and his isolation, and how it really gives you that oppressive moodiness. It's Taxi Driver 20 years before Taxi Driver even happens, it feels like.
Oh, I'd say also High and Low, when the second half of High and
absolutely.
Low. And plus, also, you have, he has all the pinups. And in High and Low, he has, the, wait, is it High and Low? I think, no, Stray Dog has, one of those two has, the killer has, a little shack with, pinup ladies in it. I can't remember which Kurosawa it is.
I think it is High and Low.
Okay.
Not Stray Dog. So I'm bad at geography. What proximity of Egypt to Italy? Obviously, much closer than we are to either of those places. And the reason I was wondering how far away they were, because like you mentioned earlier, Italian neorealism. You can't help but think about some of the more popular movies when you see this movie. But I wonder if those Italian movies did make it just over. Which is, that's why I was asking the distance, a shorter distance to Egypt.
Well,
and if that directly influenced him.
Yeah, I definitely can't speak to distribution like you were mentioning earlier. But Egypt being in North Africa, much closer to Southern Europe, for sure. And travel was definitely something happening. And this wasn't his first film either. He'd already made several. So I think he had to have at least had some sort of pulse on the international scene.
Right. You've got, Cairo is a global capital of filmmaking and otherwise. And so you contrast that with some other places like Burkina Faso, for instance. These movies, be it the French New Wave, the Italian neorealism, they're probably easily making it to the shores of Egypt, up there to in Northeast Africa, but not into the heart of the continent, maybe. There probably isn't the infrastructure either for movie theaters, things like that, in 1958.
And you have to, I think, too, think about proximity to Algeria, for example. So you've got huge French influence there, so close, in Morocco. And
oh, yeah. And Algeria and Morocco also have very active, well, I don't know Algeria as much anymore, but for a while, Algeria, Morocco, and Egypt were like a pretty big centers of film for Africa. But also on that note, just like the energy of this movie feels like it's of that particular moment, where like this is a very distinct, unique movie, and it's just like, to me, that feels like fiercely independent and distinctive. And 1958 is around when a lot of the colonies are becoming free nations, and just like, and not necessarily in story, but just like in this feeling of the movie, is this like coming into this, feels like this, the energy of like the continent is changing, and this movie feels like it's just carrying on like that vibe.
And are we at this point 2 years before or 2 years after the coup against Nasser?
I want to say after, but...
I've got it here somewhere. I'm sorry.
I was looking more at things like the radio, for example, because I was thinking about that scene with the band on the train and how basically post-1958, this is kind of the crest of all of that, and the importance and influence of entertainment media, news media, at least as used on the radio, it started to decline significantly after that. So I feel like it was cresting right before this, 1958, that broke, and then everything else is kind of a gradual decline from here.
And you're right, this is 2 years after the coup. Mm. So things are changing enormously.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, Spencer, go ahead.
Getting back to like the movie itself, since it's my first time seeing it, I really had no clue it was going to like turn into this like Hitchcockian thriller, and just like with the character and of what's that guy's name,
Kiwani,
yeah, him,
and like
Kinawi,
and with him, this like I this is a like a very basic thing to say, but I do generally love just how complex you're made to feel about him, because his introduction is like this you know, this homeless guy with like basically nothing, and then it's like, then you see like his status among everyone else, and then it turns into like, oh, he's gonna kill women. It's like, oh shit. It just like really complicates things in a very beautiful, natural, organic way.
I'm definitely transfixed by his pathology, for sure. I have a tough time with things like this, with something centered around a person who is essentially, to me, a stalker. And I think that, like you're saying, it's a complex portrayal that starts immediately. He's an adult and yet infantilized constantly, or not treated as a human at all due to his disability, but other people clearly know that something's up with him, and we see that shed pretty quickly, and that just presages nothing but terrible things to me.
I get a little bit of the Psycho thing too, in that it's not as an extreme of case where the director reels you in, you're on the side of this kind of broken person, and then all of a sudden flips it on you, and now you get to really puzzle through, how complicit do you want to be with this character's actions?
So is it just me then? Right away in my notes, I was really struggling against that idea that I'm even on his side. Mm. Because I was thinking, when we first meet Hanuma, the question to me was, how honest is a woman supposed to be with a man? Does she have to keep reiterating what everyone else already knows, and that he knows too? I'm taken, I'm not interested, etc. And I get what the music is trying to do, but it wasn't winning me over. Is that just maybe the time in which I'm watching it, possibly? My age, maybe?
I don't know, because the audience has reacted so violently to this at the initial screening that it's reported that Shaheen was even spat on afterwards. And I think it's because it's pretty radical. It was extremely sexually explicit in some places for the time, but even more so, it was shining a very bright light on the treatment of women, the harassment, the physical abuse, the danger that they constantly have to live in this culture of repression. So I don't think it's just you. I don't think it's just the time. I think he was very specifically shining a light on that.
And I do think that he is not trying to convince me that this character is the hero, even because he plays him, because he very smartly said there would be no other Egyptian actor that would take on this role of a disabled, insane person. Mm-hmm. So he was the one who had to do it. I feel like there's a lens sometimes with that some people are watching it maybe wanting to be on his side, and that it doesn't shy away that there are very real underpinnings to everything that is happening to him. He's not a demon, for example.
Yeah, like, I want to clarify, I don't think he's heroic in any way. It's just I didn't expect like a character quite like this, because going in, I was like, my gut feeling was, oh, this will be like Umberto D, like oppressive and sad. And getting something like lively and this giant collection of international influences was kind of like a shock in a good way.
And I'm sorry, I don't mean to go, I was telling Cole ahead of time, I didn't want to go too far down that road of, yelling about something. And I love that characterization of oppressive and sad, because it still is for different characters at different times. I think you put it really beautifully.
Yeah, like, luckily there was no dog scene like there's in Part 2D.
And like you, Joel, I think I was terrified that something was going to happen to that cat.
Yeah, when he starts swinging around wildly, I mean, yeah. And it, mixing in the shots, you don't exactly know what's going, because we get close into the cat's face, like, for, you know, striking the cat or anything like that. But my opinion of the main character, evil dude guy with the face, I didn't like him the second we went into his shed and he has pictures of women all over the place. And that is a violent, you know, not violent. It's just my natural reaction to all of that stuff. And it's been like that for a while. Spencer, I can't remember the last time it was like, oh no, that guy was a misogynist. So he was staring at that woman. Like, oh, we're over. But, I was never on this guy's side. I guess the music was not working for me. There were parts that I thought he was funny. You know, it didn't spoil the character, but they did have me kind of weirdly sympathetic at the end when, you know, the newspaper manager guy is talking to him and you know, telling him, oh, we're at your wedding and all that stuff like that, just to get him distracted.
Yeah, like I want to,
whereas like, oh, he is mentally ill, he's not just a man.
Yeah, but also like it's not like Vengeance is Mine, the MMR movie, where it's like it's just absolute pure evil. Like he needs help and there's no capat, and like seemingly like the only person that like even shows him any amount of respect is the newspaper man, and kind of everyone else is either nice to his face or just a bully. Even that little kid treats him like shit.
Yeah, Madbouli, basically his surrogate father, the one who intervenes for he and for Hanuma, saying we need to get to him. We need to get him to an asylum, and we must save her.
Yeah, I was really impressed by that and kind of taken aback. The elder vendor, he's the only one in the entire crowd who is promoting a humane, helpful solution, basically, to this mob. And it's so intense. And yet, I didn't expect it to go this way. I don't know if Spencer and Joel, you guys felt this way about it too, if it was a surprise the same way it was to me. I think it's remarkable that the compassion and wisdom of the village elder, quote unquote, as it were, is enough to deliver him safely into the hands of the authorities, and the mob doesn't get to lay a finger on him.
Yeah, the script didn't go that melodramatic way of giving him over to the mob.
Yeah, like that reading does make sense. Like if because like he pretty much is like the only like authority figure besides the boss, but the boss kind of is kind of barely there. Like he shows up for a couple key scenes, but the newspaper man like is really like the only real consistent like authority figure among everyone.
And the conscience of everyone.
But, Joel, so this, you're talking about the close-ups of the cat? Well, for me, the cat looks like my cat a little bit, so part of me was, like, distracted. Yeah. And so, like, it took me out of it a little bit, just personally, out of, like, it just looks like, my cat, who luckily is not playing around with any cupboards or anything right now, but you probably will.
I mean, I haven't been in person with Wednesday, but I didn't think she looked like, or this, whatever the sex of the cat in the movie, I don't want to assume, looked like Wednesday. But it kind of had a unique face, like the way it's. I've got three cats myself, so I'm used to seeing their eyes and change shape and stuff like that, but the way. This cat could get the full, you know, open lens thing that they do when they're hunting, but you know, presumably the camera, somebody's like tapping it on the side to make a jump for the camera, so it was striking to me, on top of me being an animal lover, just visually.
Yeah, and like it's, and like you get a good because it's not just like a wide shot of the cat in the room. Like you do get like a macro photography super close-up of the cat, which I can honestly say I've never quite seen like filming an animal in that way of having the extreme of like the big close-up and then like the distant shot of it, like compared to humans.
Yeah, and then the cat started rapping, which really blew my mind. That's way ahead of its time.
Did not see that coming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then Paul Abdul showed up, and it was pretty rad.
Well, yeah, that's what angered the crowd originally. No wonder he was getting spit on.
No, I think they wanted more. They wanted it to be that's all what,
exactly.
Paul.
Not enough. Why isn't she the movie?
Why isn't it 4 hours long?
I want to see the romance between the cat and the woman.
Right.
And dancing.
All right. So we touched on this character already, but Hanuma, the woman that sells the cold drinks. Her Joel, remember that I forgot what it's called, but that French movie about the school we did.
I think it was just called The Classroom or something like that.
That one. She reminds me of like a grown up version of like the annoying girl from that movie. The one you said was like
there were several annoying girls in that movie, but they're teenagers.
The one you said was like too disrespectful to the teacher and it upset you.
I think I know who you're talking about, but I didn't get. I mean, I was shocked by the way this woman looks in this movie. Like, is that even allowed over the, you know, like once again I feel xenophobic, but I feel like they were going for, you know, a Rita Hayworth or something else like that with the way she looked and she was presented. And also I can't remember who's in And God Created Women. Bridget Bardot, that's, yeah, also got that going on. And I feel like everyone should know about this woman. Like, she should be on freaking people's dream boards and stuff like that, because she's quite stunning.
Yeah, the Marilyn Monroe of Egypt.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got like some slight. I try remind me a little bit of Sophie Loren too, but I've been watching a lot of the Sophie Loren Marcello movies lately, so that might be why I was thinking that.
Yeah, she seemed also like a Fellini muse to me too, a little bit.
Yeah, with that over the top, everything kind of playing to the back row.
Yeah. Just yeah. Full sexuality. It's really beautiful, uninhibited and happy about it.
And she's the funniest character. I love when the creep is asking her to marry him and she sees like the necklace and it's my mother. She says, "Oh, then it's fake." And it's like just so mean and savage, but like it generally is very funny.
Sick burn, indeed.
Yeah. And there's another part where he's like, "And you'd be the most beautiful woman in the village." And he said, "Well, of course I would be."
Yeah. Yeah. Tell me something I don't know. I see that. Once again, I feel a little conflicted there with, I was talking about how much I disliked the main goofus bad guy. But she does tease him like here, and it doesn't excuse any behavior or something like that, but it made me kind of like, I don't know if, you know, it feels like she's playing with fire and she knows it on purpose, and I don't like that, trying to make her character seem like, oh, it could be your fault in somebody's eyes. Like, everyone, whenever she talks about things, people are always like, you must have done something. Or like the woman who said the guy was staring at her. And was like, of course, or it's your fault. You weren't wearing your veil.
Oh, yeah. I feel like in the tradition of Egyptian melodrama that was a big thing at the time, I don't think it was necessarily unique to this character and, you know, blaming the victim, anything like that. I think she may be kind of a stock character, similar to character tropes you see pop up in Bollywood over and over again. I think she was just an extreme representation. Spencer, you said you didn't see it as much as a melodrama. I think all the melodrama is contained within her character. And so it's bringing in all these things from that tradition, but all of it just lives within her rather than being throughout the entire cast.
And such an interesting line to walk that we've, as every culture, have to navigate through the years. Like I was saying earlier, how honest are you supposed to be? Do you have to understand someone's complete mental health makeup? Do they need to understand yours? Do you have to be just scrupulously honest at every moment? When is flirtation a bad thing? When is expressing yourself somehow the worst thing that can happen to another person?
And like, I feel like she's like one of more, one of the most like powerful characters in the movie, or at least like one of the smartest, because like she has to, because one, she's poor, and two, she's a woman. So in this situation, like, she has to survive, and so like that forced her to is like, as you're saying, like, figure out like when to flirt, when to suck up to people, and like when to like be sneaky and aggressive.
I think she says at one point, "I have to make my own chances."
Yeah.
I like how it even functions on a meta level, because in that scene with the band on the train, she actually breaks the fourth wall. She addresses the camera, which I thought, wow, for 1958, doing that, that's pretty radical.
Oh, yeah, and after that, I felt like getting Coca-Cola. I was pretty thirsty.
Well,
oh, good. You guys saw that, too. I thought she was just winking at me.
And then just a few moments later, that same train that's come in, we have that super interesting representation of potential queer culture with this group of women who are against marriage. And there is at least some coding that maybe one of them is a lesbian. But the whole idea is we are opposed to subjugation by men.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did not expect
this movie probably went off like a bomb.
Yeah.
It would seem like in 1958. It had to have been.
And he snuck so many interesting LGBTQ representations in his other films. And I was delighted to find something crazy like that here that feels crazy.
Yeah, and as we said earlier, almost all his movies are Netflix, and you can, and there's a couple that I read that like are very, very strong with LGBTQ themes, and you can watch those on Netflix right now. And because Netflix,
did you happen to notice if The Spare or Alexandria Y, either one of those, because those are the two at the top of my to watch list right now.
Alexandria Y is part of what, the trilogy or the four-parter that he did? Is that right?
I think that's what we're talking. I think we're talking about the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that is on Netflix currently. There's like, I think I saw at least maybe 7 or 8 of his movies.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's just very shocking. Like, I don't understand how it happened, but again, I'm glad. But also, I kind of want to watch them like back to back because I have no clue when they're going to disappear.
Sorry to bring back around. You were talking about the person disrespectful to the teacher.
Yes.
That movie's The Class from 2008.
Okay. Yeah, I mainly remember that movie being interesting, but not necessarily good.
Interesting, and yeah, I mean, no, I would tell people to watch it. Yeah, but yeah.
Maybe like once. Have you two seen The Class?
Yes.
The can winner?
No, unfortunately. No. Or maybe fortunately, based on what children.
I'm right.
Oh, it's, I don't know. We're kind of.
No, I think it's, people should watch it. I mean, it's interesting, like whether you get into the drama or not, it's an interesting subject.
Yeah, and also gets into like France and the relationship with Africa, with a bunch of different African students from different countries, and kind of like similar to like a microcosm of various things. But we did an episode on that as of now, I think a year ago, 2 years ago. I don't know how time works anymore since the quarantine. Nope, that's the wrong movie. And with I mentioned Japanese New Wave earlier. Part of this reminded me of one of my favorite movies, Gate of Flesh, the Suzuki movie. With instead of having like a group of, well, you do have a group of independent, strong-minded women, but here it's kind of all focused on Hanuma, and like she definitely would fit in with like Gate of Flesh in that world, and like and it's like kind of similar energy to it.
Which person is the Joe Shishido of this movie?
There's no Joe Shishido. There's only one Joe Shishido.
True. Just that was a test and you passed.
Yeah. And luckily, luckily there was no cow butchering scene like there is in Gate of Flesh. That I always forget is there.
Yeah, I had to watch my own cow butchering scene just to feel satisfied. Why do you make me watch movies where animals are being slaughtered?
The only one I knew about was Tukibuki. The rest were surprises. You know that.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, so like the third main character. Cause like to me, this movie is pretty much three characters. Kinoa, Ahonuma, and the union guy, whose name is Abu.
Abu.
I forgot how to say the second part. I have family who's Muslim. I should probably know how to say Muslim names. Whatever, they're not going to listen to this. Hopefully. But, yeah, and I feel like, and with Abu, like, he's, cause I feel like each character represents a different, how am I trying to say this? Like a different angle that, Kahim was going for, where, like, Abu is like the political angle of like this is what was going on at the time. Hello, as you were saying earlier, it's still very relevant. It's still like,
I feel like in a more typical movie that he would be cast as the central hero. He's the one trying to, you know, come to the defense of the working man. And especially at the end, I think it really becomes obvious he's the one that actually physically grabs the blade. When Kanawi is about to stab Hanuma, he, not just the handle, the actual blade of the knife, he wraps his hand around that, demonstrating he's willing to do whatever it takes to make her safe. So I think in a more standard film, we have him as the central character, and he is the big hero.
And then spun on its ear, this other sects within sects, like you were saying earlier, that I feel like at least in part, his push for unionization is to give him a leg up. That he's essentially a bully wherever he is going to be and always looking for the opportunity to be the strong man. And when we talk about the different complexity as well, like you were saying, Spencer, he's the different aspect of sexuality as well. He's the potent one, but his is all again twisted into jealousy.
Yeah. Although he does have sex with Hanuma.
So can I ask a stupid plot question?
Sure. Yeah.
It's probably not stupid. Is it stupid? I guess we'll find out. The girls with their buckets of soda pop, were they? It seems like they were getting the police involved and stuff like that. So it's not just a matter of like. They're taking business away from the buffets, although that's the main matter. What's the deal with that? Like, do we have any idea what specific crime they were committing?
To my mind, and correct me if you guys think I'm wrong, it's because they were unlicensed. So you've got specifically licensed vendors who I'm assuming also there's a kickback element to that. To the bureaucracy, and they are not licensed, so they're, you know, under the table, basically trying to make this money. Does that seem right?
Yeah, it's costing the legitimate vendors going both directions. They're taking business away from them, while these vendors may have possibly paid for a monopoly on the station.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And they've then got nowhere to turn because the person in charge of them, Mansoor, they talk about him as if he's a pimp. So he basically takes the huge cut off the top of that.
Yeah.
Interesting that you bring that up. Then are we treating that as a metaphor that these are a metaphor for sex workers in that case? It's not explicitly said so, but like Hanuma, they are all very voluptuous and vivacious and engaging, and so is that the metaphor that we're dancing around here?
I think so. At least they're all women, and that's got to be on purpose. Mm-hmm. And with no protection whatsoever, being run by a specific man, it seems like there's at least some connection to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you get like the seduction scene where she's seducing Abu in like the warehouse, that even though this movie's 60 years old, like that scene is still pretty powerful, and I did not expect it was like not to be pervy, but it was sexier than I expected it to turn out.
Yeah, a literal roll in the hay.
Yeah, I think that's literal. Definitely the case. Actually, and I really enjoy how many times it sounds like you and us and Joel, we all probably had several moments where we were surprised by what we were seeing from a movie from 1958, especially coming from a culture that may face a lot more censorship than ours in general.
A month ago, watched Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow, and like that sequence definitely feels like something that De Sica may have like borrowed from for like Sophie Loren's character in the third sequence, where she's playing a sex worker, and she's like teasing Marcello throughout, and it's like that's it. All right, so we've talked around it, but there's like a Hitchcockian like psycho murder subplot that develops. That's maybe like the last 20 minutes or so. Well, it doesn't really happen until the last 20 minutes, but like it's pretty striking. And like part of me feels like what if Hitchcock may have seen this, or maybe the book Psycho was out by this point. I'm not sure.
I didn't. That was another surprise in the plot when, because basically from the beginning they tell you, oh, this guy, I couldn't figure out what happened. I tried to help him, I couldn't. And then in the newspapers they're talking about, oh, somebody killing women and dismembering corpses. It's like, oh, it must be the same guy. But no, he just got inspired. Well, we're talking about the news again, how it's making killers out of us. Anyways, yeah, like, the stabbing part was like, this is gruesome. I was not expecting this particular thing. And, you know, later parts with blood dripping is like, wow.
And the blood dripping on his shoes, that's like pure Hitchcock. Like, it's just so intricate. And it's like, you know, like, it's just like the metaphor that Hitchcock always says, like, of, like, it's more tense when you know the bomb is under the table the whole time instead of it being, like, random. And, like, us seeing the blood drip is like, oh, fuck, something's gonna happen. It's like, I'm looking at the runtime, it's like, well, it's like 20 minutes left. Like, when is this gonna come to a head? And it comes to a head beautifully of, like, including everyone in the plot. And, like, and it goes, and it seems that it kind of, like, morphs from, like, this kind of separate character arcs into, like, it's everyone's arc at the end. Not arc, but, like, everyone's story at the end.
I definitely see the movement you're talking about, because that point that you mentioned, say 20 minutes from the end when everything begins to coalesce, I think it's a lot to do with those little insert shots and editing techniques that makes it feel like, you know, Strangers on a Train, when everything is starting to come together at the end of Strangers on a Train, for example.
Because we know that Kanawe is the bomb, and so we're just watching him the whole time, waiting for him to go off.
Yeah.
And in, like, the standoff, like, I was pretty convinced with how everything was going, it was going to turn to, like, oh, he's going to, like, kill her and kill himself. Because, like, it was already, like, surprising me, like, in every way. And so, with the end, like, ending in a peaceful way, it's like, oh, thank God. Like, it was a bit of a roller coaster. Like, that, like, when it all comes to a head.
And I can still hear him screaming as they take him away.
Yeah, I've seen it multiple times now, and it still makes me tense.
Yeah. And then that just incredibly beautiful actual final ending, talking about oppressive and sad again, being left with that young woman. That it just turns again on us, and we have yet another way to look at someone.
Yeah. Oh, and to go back to, like, the murder subplot, like, that's, like, pure diabolique. Is it called diabolique?
Yeah.
And I don't know if... I guess it must have gone to Egypt, because there are a lot of French... There's French in this movie, so there's probably, like, French movies being shown there. But, like, even though, like, you can call, like, a ripoff or whatever, but it's still, like, perfectly fits within the movie. That little for me, like, during the last half hour or so, I stopped taking notes because I was so engrossed in the movie. A little hard for me, like, to talk about it, because I'm still kind of reeling from it. But one of the big things for me is, I haven't brought this up in a while, but Joel, this reminded me of Daisies a little bit, and I'm not exactly sure why, but that used to be, like, the thing, like, every other episode would be like, hey, this is like Daisies, and I'd give some reason, but, like, yeah, I think maybe it's the train station, this thing, it's made me think of Daisies. And
I do love those train station scenes in Daisies, where they're sending their gentleman callers off.
So long, sucker.
Yeah. Yeah, I want to talk about Daisies. We're here to talk about a different movie. But I don't want to talk about Daisies, but you know what I mean.
Peeping Tom is another one that it reminds me of.
Just the general vibe of the whole thing.
And I also wrote Casablanca, because like the single setting, like all these different characters, it's very, very broad, but this feels like also like the North Africa setting. Yeah, like I am very happy that I decided to randomly pick this movie to do an episode on. And I don't really have much else to say. Do you guys have any final things about it?
I think we've pretty much covered everything. It's just fun to think about. The thing I keep coming back to is what an impact it probably made, how fun it would have been to be in the audience in 1958. You know, you're raised on this diet of kind of staid and formulaic melodrama, and all of a sudden you think that may be what you're going to see, and then all of a sudden you get this instead, and what a thrill that would have been.
This breakneck pace for basically 11 hours is covered, and there's no moment that isn't a constant struggle.
And like to reiterate, like even though it is like kind of a neorealist film, it is not as like oppressively sad as like Umberto D or Bicycle Thieves can get. It is like oppressive and sad, but there is still that air of like some characters are funny, some are like very political and serious, and some are sad, and you get like a good mix of humanity, but you never but there's never like too big of a break from like the reality of the of what's going on.
I feel like it has more in common with your 50s era film noir, you know, no ear, apologies, I don't speak any French, than an Italian neorealism. Like, that's... I feel like going into Cairo, it's too late if you're already here, and going into Cairo Station blind was probably the best thing for me.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I was just continually surprised and pleasantly the whole time.
Okay. So, Joel, are you going to watch his other movies that are on Netflix currently?
I'm more likely to watch those than anything else at the moment. Like, those sound interesting to me. I'm kind of bored with... I've been doing a lot of rewatching older things, and the idea of watching, like, a superhero movie right now just feels gross. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that sounds more likely to me, yeah.
Are you...
Make sure, check out what the good ones are and tell me.
You can be like me and watch Cynthia Rothrock movies. Nonstop.
Yeah.
I started that one. I haven't finished it yet, though.
You gotta finish it. She's amazing.
Did you watch it?
Not yet. I'm watching the ones that are on YouTube in full and dubbed in English.
Oh, I see.
And there's a pretty good amount if you look.
I'm not surprised. Yeah, I'm after this. Just watching the beginning part of that one. I wish I could remember what it was called off the top of my head.
Out for Justice.
Out for Justice, yes. Generic title, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
I'm really excited to watch some more of that. So, okay. Yep, I'm not going to watch any more Egyptian movies. Thanks a lot, Spencer.
Okay, fine. But Cole America, you guys have done a couple of episodes on African films. So what are your favorite African films that you've seen or done episodes on or like or whatever?
Yeah, absolutely. I've got two of them. We've done episodes on these. Darat, you mentioned this earlier, Spencer, from 2006, about A Young Man's Quest for Revenge. Hyenas from 1992. That's amazing. A woman from this man's past comes back and makes a big bribe on his life to get some revenge as well. And then a couple of others that I would love to mention. There's a great documentary from 2007 called This is Nollywood about Nigeria's massive film industry. And then another one that is unfortunately more on the oppressively sad end, which would be La Pirogue from 2012 about a group of people trying to flee Senegal to get to Spain.
Yeah, those are all fantastic. Let's watch those again instead right now. Actually, I've got a bunch too.
Well, we still have to get to Atlantics.
Yeah, there's tons and tons. Yeah, when I went through that year-long process, I found tons that I loved. And Erica mentioned a couple already, but I also would throw in there the little girl who sold the sun. That's full of beautiful energy. Rafiki, I really loved. It's kind of coming out of that Afro bubblegum movement, and it's doing double duty here too. It's dealing with LGBTQ issues, and then it stands in stark opposition to that. All African films are about misery, misconception, and then
You could argue the little girl.
I'm sorry?
You could say the little girl who sold the sun is breaking from that tradition too, of all African films are about misery.
Definitely. And then Boudyam is probably my next favorite down that list. It's really a beautiful example, I think, of the oral folktale tradition being adapted to the movies.
What you didn't mention was the super action movies where the guy's doing the hype man.
Who killed Captain Alex.
Yeah. And then the one where he cast his little kids as the, what were they? Crime fighters? Gangsters?
They were super ninjas, basically.
Oh, okay.
African film is great. And I think one of the things that I had reiterated for me going through all that, we tend to think of it, or at least I think the general movie-going audience, when they hear African film, they think starvation, famine, and civil war. If you're just an average, run-of-the-mill, multiplex moviegoer, that's what you're given over and over again. But, you know, 50 films, if I was doing film noir or Italian neorealism, that's a lot, it seems like. That would be, I would be able to get a handle on a movement. But 50 films to cover an entire continent of cinematic output, just scratching the surface, and there's so much diversity. The big problem is just distribution.
Yeah, it's something I always talk about on here, but it's just Netflix has a decent amount, just you have to actually actively search for it, and Amazon Prime has a decent amount, but you have to actually search for it. But then if it's like a movie from maybe before 2000, good luck trying to find it. Which is just part of the, like, there are people like Scorsese who are doing good work, but outside of that, it's just kind of like, it's kind of tough. And
yeah,
and I've gone through some non-legal means to get a hold of some that I don't think I've ever been, like, released outside of, like, Europe that are, you know, decent quality, but kind of varies, but that's kind of the reality of it. If, like, if you want to see these movies, you kind of have to you have to work for it if it's, like, older than, like, say 20 years or so.
And right. It's tough if you don't even know where to get started. If you don't know what you don't know.
Yeah, if you're not familiar with the gray market, let's say, you wouldn't even know where to begin. There are companies, there's one I really like, Art Matin Productions, I think that's out of New York City.
They did the Darat release,
they've done these kind of two-for-one sets of modern classic African films. They haven't put out a huge catalog, but there's at least a place to start right there.
Yeah, and I might be familiar with Darat a little bit. It might be one of my favorite movies. I may have talked about it on Flixwise Canada about 2 years ago.
Yeah.
Actually, I'm doing another Haroon episode. We have done two so far.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah, I think the last ones left are like Grigri's, which I'm not the biggest fan of, but I can still talk about that one. Have you guys seen that?
That one was on Netflix or Prime for a long time, too.
Yeah, it still is, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've seen that, and I'm kind of in the same boat as you. My two favorites, Darat and A Screaming Man, would be my other top recommendation.
Yeah, and Abuna is like right behind that. Abuna is so good, which we probably won't do. It's a little too late. And, girl, you need to have to get a DVD because it's not streaming ever, unfortunately.
Yes, I fear physical media.
Yeah. But, where was it? Okay, 1958. That was a pretty big year for movies. And we'll start with the guests. What movies from that year would you guys recommend?
I would like to recommend one. I think, again, this is one of those gray market things that I had to do. But there's a great Norwegian movie from 1958 called Lake of the Dead that's directed by Kara Bergstrom. And it's a really fun Norwegian kind of proto-cabin-in-the-woods-style horror movie a group of friends go and encounter strange supernatural circumstances, and there's a haunted lake, and it's just all shot so beautifully. It's a forerunner of, you know, your Mario Bava Bay of Blood type thing. It's not nearly that graphic. It's much more supernatural in tone, but it's a really fun mystery.
And a creepy local legend with a very uncomfortable modern day adaptation. Weird pathology among family members.
Yeah, definitely. Don't want to spoil too much. But yeah, sorry. If you are a denizen of the gray market, Lake of the Dead, you can get that from your typical sources.
Okay, and you mentioned Mario Bava. There's a moment in Cairo Station that felt like a Bava moment when Kinawi was revealed with a knife, like behind the woman. It felt like Bay of Blood. And that's it.
What about you, Erica? What's your?
I picked one of my very, very, very favorites, Elevator to the Gallows, which is a Louis Malle film with Jean Moreau and Maurice Rone, who, if you've seen Purple Noon, you might recognize. And it's all about the murder of a businessman by the lover of the man's wife, and everything goes very downhill. I'm totally mesmerized by this movie, and in the same way that music in Cairo Station shows this changing culture, the score here is by Miles Davis, and you've also got Jean Moreau's voiceover, and they're both haunting together. And it's also got a great noir sensibility as well.
All right. That might be coming up in our next season, actually. John Cribbs claimed that one. And spoiler, we're going to do a Louis Malle episode next season of Elevator, Gallows, and One Source of the Z. I forgot what it's called. But,
I'm busy that day.
Okay, that's fine.
I'm just kidding.
J-Dog, you got stuff from 1958?
No. We already did this.
Yeah, we did this like 2 years ago in our first season.
Yeah, exactly. So if I'm going to recommend anything, I'm going to recommend my favorite Kurosawa movie, The Hidden Fortress.
Mm-hmm. I almost went with that one.
Yeah, it's so much fun, and it's so thrilling. Like, it feels like a Spielberg or what's that guy who did that space movie? Anyways, like, this is the one that's referenced when people say, like, Lucas stole things for Star Wars from The Hidden Fortress, you know, and there's certain aspects. We talk about it in that episode. But it's... I don't feel like, obviously, they could have just followed this plot completely in the space movie, and The Hidden Fortress feels so unique. I don't typically think of them in the same way. Like, that... Right now, I'm just thinking about sword battle between is it Shimura?
Nope. Is he? Shimura has maybe 5 minutes in the beginning. It's him and
it's Mifune and
Susumu Fujita.
Is that the guy that was in?
That was Kurosawa's go-to guy in the '40s before Toshiro came along.
He was in the judo movies.
Yeah,
right.
He has a great smile.
Yeah, like. I love that scene so much. I could watch it over and over again. And there's so many other scenes in.
I'm sorry, but it's spears, not swords. I have to be that guy.
Oh yeah, you're right. You're right. Okay. See, I got to go watch it again. You're right. Okay. Anyways, Hidden Fortress is really good. The other movie, I assume, is Rickshaw Man.
Yeah, we covered that.
Yeah. Same year. Also has Toshiro Mifune, because he was the guy.
Oh, fuck. I can bring this up now. Rickshaw Man is a remake that was written by the father of Juzo Itami, who was a screenwriter and director.
That's cool. It says here in the description that it's a remake.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah, Itami's dad wrote...
Same director.
...wrote the original. And I think they use the same script. But Itami's dad had died like 12 years before the remake came out.
Anyways, Rickshaw Man is just a kind of a typical Japanese drama, but Mifune's character is joyful and heartbreaking in some scenes, and I strongly remember the image that they have on Letterboxd shows him playing the drum, and that scene is pretty great, where he climbs onto a parade float, basically, and starts showing them how to really play those drums.
Yep. That's all you got? Nothing else? No, like, was there Hitchcock from that year you like or something?
I don't know. I don't think so.
Oh. Okay.
I mean, I've seen other movies. Okay. Ashes and Diamonds. Fiend Without a Face. Those are good, too.
All right.
I think Vertigo came out that year.
I think that is Vertigo.
Speaking of Hitchcock.
Oh, yeah, it is. That's the number one. Yeah, yeah. You know, that movie's all right if you like
okay.
good movies, I guess.
Yeah, but for me, I'll start with one that at least three out of the four people here have seen, Invention for Destruction. It's a delightful... Fuck, I don't say Yuri Parta director. That's a different Czech director. Fuck, what is his name?
Carol Zeman.
That's it. And if you like his a very distinct style, you'll like this. However, like, if someone says they don't like this movie, first off I'd say, what's wrong with you? But then I'd say, I can understand that it not clicking with some people. But it's so distinctive and so intricate, and like, I don't know how to even explain it in a concise way. It just absolutely needs to be seen and witnessed. And I might be on Criterion Channel, but I have the DVD. I pre-ordered it as soon as like Criterion announced they were gonna release some of Zeman's films. And he has a bunch of other movies he made later on that are on Amazon to rent. And I do recommend his later stuff. It's not as good, at least to me, but it's still very like distinctive and very very much worth watching. But my other one is other two, Le Beau Surge. It's a Claude Jabrer film, and it's considered like one of the first French New Wave movies. And this character piece of this guy goes back to his home village after a long time and just sees his old friend and his friend Serge. And this kind of is him hanging out with his friend Serge and going back to his hometown and just realizing how things have changed and this what life is like there. And I we're going to talk about next season. I won't say too much about it, but I do highly recommend Le Beau Surge. And Voice Without a Shadow, which is a Seiji Suzuki movie. It's part of the Diamond Guys Arrow box set that Joel, you got me for my birthday last year. And it's the first Suzuki movie with Joe Shishido in it. And I won't say much more beyond that, because it's kind of part of it is like you should go into it blind, but you get early Hoshido. This is like right when he gets like those puffy cheeks, and so it's like the start of like the iconic George Hoshido era, and it's just a nice little noir. It feels like a Hitchcock movie, and it's just a nice little B movie. And and that is it. Cole and Erica, plug your podcast and what other stuff you guys do.
Yeah, we are the Magic Lantern, and you can find us everywhere you would imagine. Just search for Magic Lantern Podcast on Facebook or YouTube or Spotify. We are on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, anywhere you get your podcasts, you can find us. The website is just magiclanternpodcast.com. We are on Twitter at @lantern_cast is where you can interact with us on Twitter.
Come join our Facebook group too. We have lots of fun conversations over there.
And J-Dog, this will come out late September, mid-September, around that time.
After a bunch of other ones have come out, I take it?
Yeah.
Anyway, let me just start off with an apology. I'd like to apologize to everyone that is involved in the podcast that was already called Customers Also Watched. Actually, I think it's just one person. But I found out today that this thing that I'd written up probably like 3 years ago and had only checked back then whether somebody had made a podcast called Customers Also Watched. There wasn't one back then, but last year a person did start that podcast, and they are well over 50 episodes in, still going. So that thing that I had talked about previously that I worked on and already recorded 4 episodes of, I haven't come up with a new name yet, but that's coming soon. The Vampire Podcast, on the other hand, The Dead Travel Fast, by the time this episode comes out, all of our episodes should be up, because I'm going to be doing that this weekend. Other than that, 150 plus episodes of my science fiction podcast that I did with my co-hosts Aaron and Sarah still available in the usual places. That's Please Don't Send Me Into Outer Space.
Yeah,
still on hiatus, not gone, don't worry.
Yeah, Aaron is a daddy now, so he's a little busy.
Also, on top of all the rest of the stuff that's going on with the world.
That too, but
that prevents us from hanging out.
Yeah, but a baby kind of gets in the way.
He could bring his baby and record the podcast. I don't care if there's a baby crying, you know.
Okay.
I'm doing the podcast for Joel.
All right. But,
I've got a title for you, Joel, I think, for your podcast that needs to change its name.
Oh, sure.
How about Out for Justice?
Oh, good. Minute by Minute Podcast by Joel Torres. I will write that down and get back to everybody involved. A small finder's fee will be available if we choose it.
All right. What is coming? By this time, maybe my grind bin on Street Trash will be out. I don't know. Those guys kind of record months ahead, which is I'm not really sure when episodes will drop. But Street Trash is on Shudder still. If you like stupid, gross horror comedies, watch it. If not, it's fine. It's not for everyone. But also, spoiler alert, in an episode, I talk about Shelley Duvall, because I always have to shoe in Shelley Duvall if I can. But what else comes out? Or it will be Sex Lives and Videotape. But basically, by this point, by the time this comes out, it will be like a month left. So I'm not sure when I'm dropping this, but it'll be around that time. But that's it. You can tell your friends, family, whatever about it, and see you guys next time for Splatoon, Sex Lives and Videotape, or all three.
Yeah, also, thanks for being on.
I was getting to that.
Oh, okay. I thought you, because usually you just hit the eject button, and all of a sudden the tape's on the floor.
No. Cole and Erica, thanks for coming on.
Our pleasure. Thank you.
You're welcome, man. And watch Cairo Station. It's on Netflix. The show's email is highandlowpod@gmail.com. It made no sense to change email, so it's the same feed. The show can be found at podbean.com, and Spotify, and other places you can find podcasts. Please rate and review whenever possible. The logo is by Josh Hollis. The music is by James Fell. And thank you for listening.